Everybody talks about the 69 Cubs, but what about the forgotten 1970 Chicago Cubs? The book is called Go and Glow, and it's by Bill Bike, who went to his first Cubs game back in 67 when his mom and another mom brought the kids to the game on Ladies' Day. And Bill, I found the book really interesting because I had forgotten how close they came in 1970. That was a pretty good team, wasn't it?
It really was a good team, Bob. And, you know, like I said in the title of the book, it's the forgotten team. But it was actually, when you think about it, a more interesting season than 69 was. In 70, they had some better players. They had Milt Pappas and Joe Pepitone, who were fan favorites that year and for the next few years, and who really contributed to the Cubs contending for the next few years. It was a fantastic pennant race. It was a multi-team race between the Cubs, the Pirates, and the New York Mets. Sometimes they'd only be separated by a half a game, a few percentage points. It was also the year that the concept of beautiful Wrigley Field really was established. The broadcasters had used that term before, but by 1970, the place was getting a little shabbier, a little rougher, and so the Cubs made some mid-season changes in the middle of the season to improve Wrigley Field. And also Leo DeRocher, who had run his players ragged in 69 by just playing the same guys every day, he actually entered the modern era and he started playing some rookies. So put that all together along with some good trades and some bad trades, and it was really a very interesting season.
Well, what's really interesting in light of what happened with the Cubs this year is in 1970, the Cubs had a 12-game losing streak. They had been in first place, and after that losing streak, management decided to go out and acquire players, didn't they? They weren't getting rid of anybody, but of course it was before free agency and the big contracts.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Bob. This year, when the Cubs started getting rid of players like Javi Baez, Chris Bryant, Anthony Rizzo, they were 9.5 games behind, and the New York Yankees over in the American League East, they were also 9.5 games behind, but they started acquiring players. And so the Yankees are back in the race, and the Cubs are not. And in 1970, the Cubs were kind of like the Yankees are this year. They didn't give up. They went out and got more players. They got Milt Pappas. They got Joe Pepitone. They got a pitcher named Juan Pizarro, who had been the White Sox best pitcher in the mid-1960s. And so the Cubs actually got themselves back into the race just like the Yankees did this year. So there's two ways to go. And the Cubs in 70 did it the way the Yankees did it in 2021, and it really paid off for them.
Talking about trades, Cubs lore, of course, includes the famous trade Lou Brock for Ernie Broglio back in the early 60s, the worst trade ever. You point out that the gamble for Callison trade was not far behind. Talk about that a little bit.
It really wasn't. The Cubs brought up Oscar Gamble late in 1969, figuring that they were going to be in the World Series, and they actually brought Oscar up in August so he would qualify for the postseason roster. So they were set in center field with Oscar Gamble. They actually told him he would be the Cubs center fielder for the next 10 years. They had a great starting rotation that included Dick Selma. Jim Hickman had really come on at the end of 69, so he was their right fielder. And then the Cubs went out and made an inexplicable trade, you know, as they often did, trading young, fast guys for old, slow guys. So they traded Gamble to the Philadelphia Phillies for their right fielder, Johnny Callison, who had been a good player in the mid-60s, but by 70 he was fading. So they traded a young outfielder for an old outfielder. Now they had two right fielders. They had Jim Hickman and John Callison. They had no center fielder. And to make a bad deal unbelievably worse, they threw in one of their starting pitchers, Dick Selma, who the Phillies ended up using him as a relief pitcher that year, and he's one of the best pitchers, best relief pitchers in the National League in 1970. So suddenly a team that had no holes, had a hole in center field, had a hole in the starting rotation, and that really hurt him for about half the season in 1970.
Bill, was it 1970 kind of the beginning of the end for Leo DeRocher? I know he came back in 71, but was that where maybe the bloom had worn off?
That's exactly it, Bob. You know, the media had been very high on DeRocher up until then. There was the little incident in 69 where He took a day off to went to his stepson's summer camp in Wisconsin, and he Leo got in a little trouble for that, but really only took one day off and still really didn't really care about it that much, so that kind of went away. But in 1970, as you say, that's when the bloom went off the rose, and one of the, for really one of the oddest reasons possible, Leo had a radio show that year with WIND, and in June, Leo decided to quit talking not only to the media, but to the players too, and he was only going to reveal things that moves he was going to make on his radio show. So the media immediately soured on Leo. The players didn't know what was going on, and so that was really the year that Leo kind of proved that he wasn't the genius that everybody thought he was. Leo was still there in 71. He actually managed for half of 72, but 70 was really the year that people started realizing that he wasn't really the greatest manager that people thought he was.
You know what I remember, 1970, you mentioned Dick Selma. He, of course, was sort of the cheerleader for the Bleacher Bums and in 69. And then in 70, because of all the craziness in 69 and fans throwing junk on the field from the outfield, they put that basket in there, didn't they?
That's exactly it. It's very, very rare that a team makes a change to the dimensions of the field in mid-season. But what happened, the last game of the 69 season, I was there with my mom and another mom and some other kids because, you know, Wrigley Field was mostly kids back then. So the last game of the 69 season, people were jumping on the field. People were throwing garbage on the field, and that continued in the first homestand of 1970, where people jumped on the field, threw garbage on the field. The outfield wall had a flat top at the time, and so people would actually, like, put a beer on the top of the wall and have races to see who could get the beer. So the place was just kind of getting crazy. You know, that was the era of Richard Nixon, the Vietnam War. It was just, you know, people were getting angrier in society, and so that first homestand saw actually a lot of fights. And so after that first homestand, and the Wrigley family really had a choice because there were a lot of older parks, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and they were in rundown neighborhoods, and you know, kind of the drunks were taking over a little bit. And the Wrigley family did not want that to happen to Wrigley Field. They wanted it to be the friendly confines, beautiful Wrigley Field. So they got league permission to change the dimensions of the field. So they put the basket in the outfield. That kept people from jumping on the field and from throwing garbage on the field. They cemented a triangular piece of concrete on the top of the outfield wall so it was no longer flat, so people couldn't use it as a jumping-off point or have their beer races on the wall anymore. And they actually got Chicago police as security guards, so that helped the security a little. But they also, for the first time since the 1940s, got female ushers. And in that more genteel era, you know, the idea was that drunks wouldn't take a swing at a woman. And it kind of proved to be right. The female security guards really helped out. So 70 was the year it became the friendly confines, beautiful Wrigley Field. And it's been that way since then.
It's a very interesting book, kind of a combination of Where Are They Now and also a play-by-play of a pretty good season. You still had Banks, Sano, and Williams on that club, Ernie's 500th home run. The forgotten 1970 Chicago Cubs, Go and Glow, Bill Bike. Appreciate it, Bill. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Bob. Really appreciate it.
And we will call Bill after the show and remind him that Dave Bennett asked the question about Leo DeRocher.
That's okay. Not me. That's okay. I'm over it.